You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I talk with actor Will Forte. Anyone reading Wikipedia's entry on Forte couldn't be blamed for suspecting it's a prank. High school class president and football player, college history major, and promising financial broker. Seriously? Entries for his more recent past, such as roles in The Groundlings, Saturday Night Live, and MacGruber, seem more like the real Will Forte, until you watch his subtly astounding turn in Nebraska. Director Alexander Payne considered over 100 actors for the role of David, all of whom wanted it badly. It's understandable, given the Oscar buzz and critical acclaim the film and cast have generated. So how does MacGruber wind up as the kind voice of reason in a bleak cinematic landscape populated by bitter, deluded characters? Forte says, maybe Alexander Payne had the best answer when he said that directors often choose actors because they think 80% of the character is already you. Indeed, Forte's performance is so genuine, honest, and stripped down, it makes us wonder if the whole wacky, funny guy thing is just an act. Any comedy we see in his character is of the absurdly sad sort that Payne has a genius for capturing. It's hard not to draw parallels between the physical journey David takes in the film and Forte's journey as an actor. He is grateful for every moment of the experience and excited about what comes next. At Off Camera, so are we. So pull up a chair and listen in.
So, Will Forte, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You and I met on the set of the Hopeless Wanderer video that
yes.
I shot for Mumford & Sons, in which you and Jason Sudeikis, Ed Helms, and Jason Bateman all played caricatures of the band.
Yes.
And you were all brilliant in your own way, but I think that your decision to really commit to humping a stand-up bass was probably my favorite moment on the video.
Well, I was asked to hump the stand-up bass, and I'm not going to half-ass the humping of a bass. If I'm asked to do it, I'm going to really have sex with that thing.
Did I ask you to hump the bass?
I was asked by you to hump the thing.
Well, then my therapist owes me a lot of money.
It was also your stand-up bass, from what I remember, right?
Yes, it was. Actually, it's my wife's. But that's another story.
She doesn't have to know.
No, but, you know, one of the things I thought about that whole scene later in watching it and comparing it to the things you've done in the past is your commitment to go with something and take it all the way. Like you just said, you won't go halfway on something. And I think that commitment makes your humor kind of unique in some ways. When you discovered that? When you discovered that I can keep saying this thing until it becomes hilarious?
I don't know where that came from.
Yeah.
I do like repetition comedy, and I think it's just a waiting game. It's just like, it's almost daring the audience, you know, just saying like, well, I'm gonna keep doing it.
Right.
You're gonna have to respond at some point, and you do take that chance that they might never respond, and then it's really, really horrible. But usually, if you just keep doing it, they have to. They just can't just, like, even if it's just to get you to shut up, they'll respond in some way. So it's like, okay, we've had enough of this. So if you just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do love repetition comedy, though, I do. But
well,
you just
gotta be
prepared for heartache, though.
Yeah?
Yeah. If it doesn't work out.
Has that ever backfired for you?
Oh, sure.
But
only, you know, when it backfires is when you don't just totally commit to it. If you do fully commit to it and just keep going, it will rarely backfire.
Do you remember a comedian that you looked up to maybe doing something like that and maybe registering with you?
No, not. I mean, I know that people have. You know, I'm definitely not the first person to do that kind of thing. But I my favorite people were like Steve Martin,
right?
David Letterman, Peter Sellers. Those were like my three main people, and they were all really deep. Well, not Letterman, but Peter Sellers and Steve Martin would, you know, deep character people.
Yeah.
Letterman would just do absurd stuff. But they would all do absurd stuff.
I think they were all absurd surrealists in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I can see that in your, you know, in your humor. And I realized I don't know that much about how you got started. I mean, I know you were on the Groundlings and you went to SNL, but earlier than that, were you, as a kid, were you interested in being a comedian, being a writer, or was there something at a young age that you're like, I'd really like to do that?
I would always have fun with my friends. We'd make up our own radio shows, and I was a huge fan of Saturday Night Live. I do remember thinking, oh, that would be really fun to get to do that for a living, because, you know, back then you don't know that, oh, that's their job. People actually can do that for a career. Like, I guess I didn't know that. But then as I got older, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. Didn't really give it too much thought, and just thought I'd do what my dad did. And he was he worked at a brokerage firm. So that's what I started doing.
Well, I read about that. In fact, let's talk about using America's most trusted journalistic resource, Wikipedia. It says that you were class president, voted best personality, and you played football.
Yeah. Yeah, all those things are true. Freshman class president. I don't think I did anything all year. I don't even remember what I promised. I don't think I made a bunch of promises during my speech.
No.
I just said, we'll have a great year. If you elect me freshman class president, we'll have a great year. And then I think we had a great year, but
did
none
you?
Of it had to do with anything that I did. I don't even remember. We had to do one thing, which was sell garlands during Christmas season. Some other person in the freshman class cabinet kind of did most of
there
that.
There was a cabinet?
Oh, yeah. You have your vice president and your treasurer and the secretary. And I just presided.
I see.
I did a lot of delegating or ignoring.
I mean, I always thought people that did all that, they kind of had a master plan for success.
Yeah.
Like, was there anything behind that? Like, I will be well-liked in student government and play a lot of sports, and I will go on to great success?
I think that a lot of it was making sure you had stuff on your resume for college stuff.
Right.
You know, I wanted to make sure I had I was part of a bunch of clubs and groups, and, you know, try to have the thickest resume that I could.
Yeah.
And I had a pretty thick one. It was empty but thick. It was like a lot of, I was the president of the Spanish Honorary Society my senior year.
Really?
And all that, the club had been defunct for years. And so we asked our Spanish teacher if he would let us resurrect it. He said, yeah, sure. And we didn't do anything, but we had a whole cabinet of people who got to put down on their college resumes, like, Spanish Honorary Society president, which was me.
Yes.
Spanish Honorary Society vice president, which was somebody else. I don't even remember, because we had one lunch. We one day for lunch, my mom brought in a bunch of tortillas and beans and stuff. We had this awesome, delicious lunch, but that was, it certainly wasn't too much of a club. It was great. Great lunch.
Now, you actually did work in a brokerage house for a year, correct?
I did.
You did. And that,
I did.
Was that when you were still in college, or
I
after?
Was, I interned at the place for about a year or half a year as I was just finishing up college. And then I worked there for about a year, year and a half after college. I didn't ever take the Series 7, but the guy that I was working for had asked me if I would be like his junior partner, and then he would sponsor me taking the Series 7. And it just wasn't for me. I liked everybody there. It was a good group, and I just couldn't see. It just didn't make me happy doing that stuff.
So was there a moment when you said, I've got to make a change? How did you make that jump from Brokerage House to Groundlings or to comedy or whatever it was?
I think that I thought, oh, I'll just live my life and be discovered. You know, what? Here's this kind of schlumpy looking dude. Who's going to discover me? You know, you hear old Hollywood stories of, you know, Marilyn Monroe types who got discovered walking. People like me don't get discovered. You have to really work very hard. So after a while, I realized, oh, there's no scenario in which anybody would ever discover me unless I work towards it. I would be the person they would say, could you step aside? I want to discover that person behind you. So I had heard of this, the Groundlings, and I definitely at some point had thought, oh, it'd be fun to try to do comedy. I don't remember where it came from. It might have been something I kind of wanted to do my whole life. I think that had always been there my whole life, but I don't remember when it became this realistic thing to me or where it got to a point where I thought, oh, maybe I'll really actually give this a shot. But it was somewhere around the time that I was at the brokerage firm, and it just felt like I had to do something besides that. It was a real bottoming out situation, because I was down in Los Angeles. I went to UCLA. You know, what am I going to do? Am I going to move back up to Northern California and try to find something to do up there? Or should I just, as long as I'm down here, maybe give it a shot? You know, there's it's not like I've invested too much time in anything else. I might as well just give it a shot, I guess.
Other than the brokerage firm, did you have any straight jobs?
No. I worked for a landscape architect, rolling rocks around and pulling weeds, and I worked up on the docks in Alaska for a summer.
Did you really?
Other than that, my parents were really good about, they were wonderfully supportive. They said, if you get good grades, we will give you an allowance.
Okay.
And I got good grades. But then, you know, you graduate from college and there's no place to get good grades anymore. So you have to make money somehow. So somewhere along the way, decided I'm going to try to act, and I'm going to start trying to write also. Because writing, you don't have to really put yourself out there. It just felt like a kind of something I could do away from people. And I was really shy. For some reason, to me, telling people I wanted to go into comedy was almost like bragging. It was, you were essentially saying, oh, I think I'm funny enough to make it in comedy, and that I was uncomfortable with that. I felt like that seemed like a weird form of bragging, so I didn't want to, I don't know, it was just, there was, does that make sense?
Like, you didn't want the person you were telling, you didn't want to imagine what they're saying in their head.
Yeah.
Oh,
are you crazy? Why would you think that you could make it in comedy? I was just very self-conscious about that. I didn't want to me saying, oh, I'm going to try to do comedy was saying, hey, I think I can make it in comedy. I think I'm really funny. And that felt weird and gross to me. So
did you not have like a group of guys that all wanted to get into comedy, or you were kind of finding your way on your own?
Along the way, you meet people and become friends with them. But I didn't have any other friends that I can think of that were trying to do it at the same time. So it was, I had a friend who was interested in writing, so we wrote together, and after a while you just start figuring out who you are as a comedian, what you have to offer, and went to the Groundlings at about the same time, which is a improv sketch place, and started doing doing stuff there, and you just get confidence along the way. Some people have it right from the get-go, but I was very shy. Well, it was a weird mixture because I was always confident, but also shy at the same time, which I don't know. You know, I deep down, I really, you can't deep down think you're, you know, you have to deep down believe in yourself or you got no shot.
Sure.
But I don't know, there was a weird layer of shyness also that still exists.
Really?
Yeah.
I imagine you slinking out of the brokerage house and sneaking into a open mic night or something. Was there a moment of that where you were kind of like, I'll go try this out? And...
Well, I did. I remember I did go to the Groundlings. You have to audition to make it into the first level. It's a series of levels you have to go through that are, it's like a school, and they're always kind of weeding people out, and everybody makes it to the next level. But at a certain point, you are auditioning to get into the actual company. And so I think in the very beginning, I tried out for the first level while I was still at the brokerage firm. There was a little crossover at first, and then I was enjoying it to the point that I thought, oh, this is what I want to be doing. So I went and told the people at the brokerage firm, I'm going to give it a shot. And I will always, everyone was actually very supportive, except there was this one woman that I'll always remember. It said, like, well, you'll be back, or something like that. Like, no, you, just the worst thing you want to hear, something like, you know, just, oh, do you know how many people try to do that? It just whatever it fed into my fear that I had in the first place, like, oh, you think you're that funny type thing?
Exactly.
I forget exactly what she said. I love that I'm explaining to you. This was such a big moment when she said this, and now I can't even remember what she said, but.
Well, I'm sure she's watching this, so.
Yes.
Now you're here.
You were wrong. You were wrong. And then it was to the point where I loved it so much that I knew it was what I had to be doing. Whether I was gonna have any success or not, it made me so happy that it was what I wanted to do and succeed at or fail at. It didn't matter. It made me happy enough so that I knew that it was what I should be doing.
I read something the other day that said, if someone tells you you're spending far too much time at something, then you're on the right track.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? One of the parallels I notice in talking to a lot of artists is, at some point, there was no choice at all. It was just, you loved it too much, you had to make it your whole life.
Yeah.
Was there a call you made to your dad and said, Dad, I'm not going to be a broker? Or was he totally supportive?
He never put that pressure on me to do that. Oh, yeah. When I brought up the fact that I was going to try comedy, my mom was very supportive. My dad was very supportive. Everyone in my family. But that's the kind of family I have, this great, supportive family. It's not the same for all the people that I met who were going through comedy, and so I just got really, really lucky to have that kind of support just right off the bat.
I've read about your SNL audition and what you did and how you brought sketches from the Groundlings, but I did wonder, since you did have a steady job at that point, you were a writer on That 70s Show.
Yes.
When you were told you got the part on SNL, that you got the job, was there any hesitation in taking it, or was it like, you're all in? Packing your bags?
Oh, every step of the way with SNL terrified me. It was, when I went into the Groundlings, it was to go to SNL. Like that's, I think most people who are starting at the Groundlings, that's their goal at least it was for me. And I feel like most people, you go there and you go, all right, I want to try to get to SNL. And then along the way, I started getting writing jobs. That part of my life just kind of took off, and I loved it. I loved writing, and after several years of of doing that, I just thought, oh, I don't think I need the performance stuff to make me happy. It'd be great if I got a chance to act and stuff, but I'm totally happy as a writer. And then when this opportunity came up and I had this job I loved at the 70s show and just everything about that 70s show job was great. We had just found out we were picked up for 2 seasons. There's not a lot of job security, a lot of writing jobs.
Right.
Loved everybody I worked with. The hours were insanely good. It was just the greatest experience of all time. Then I get this audition for SNL, and it's like, why? It terrified me because you're presented with this dream. It's like, do you give up this wonderful writing job that you've worked so hard to get for this dream that you... I was just terrified I was not gonna do a good job, and that, you know, I wanted this dream to still exist for me, and what if I went over there and just sucked at it and got fired, and then all of a sudden I don't have my job at the 70s show and I have this exploded dream. I don't know. So I finally decided that I would audition, ended up getting the job, and then told them that I wasn't gonna do it. And
so you told Saturday Night Live.
I told Saturday Night Live I wasn't gonna do it.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so for a year I went back to 70s show, and the whole time I was thinking, God, should I have done that? I don't know. I told myself, oh, maybe I'll, during this year, I'll write at 70s show, but I'll also make short films and I'll do this and I'll do that. And I played video games the entire year. I didn't do anything.
Were you in some sort of a like state of shock? Like you didn't, like almost when you can't make a decision, you just go into that state of inactivity? Or
I still have a newspaper where I was flipping coins. It had heads and tails, and I think one side was, I forget what was go to SNL, what was not, but it had even come down to that, where I was trying to see what fate would do. And I think the go to SNL won out over don't go to SNL, and I still just didn't go. I was scared.
So did you put them off for a whole year?
Yeah, I just said, you know what, I'm just gonna stay at this job. I made up some kind of excuse. But what it comes down to is I think I was just scared to go over and try it and fail. And my bosses at 70s show, they were wonderful, and they even said, like, go, do it, try it. You can always come back.
You can always be a PA when you come back.
Yeah. but I don't know, I just said, no, that's all right.
Do you ever think about what the room was like when you said that?
I think everybody thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
I forget what story I made up, like, no, it's better this way, it's, you know. But it was really, for that whole year, I had doubted the decision I made. I felt like, oh, I think I might have made a huge mistake. And, you know, when will I have this opportunity to perform again? And I thank God after the next year they came back and saw if I wanted to change my mind, and thank God, because that's definitely was, I just thought I had lost the opportunity and might have made the biggest mistake of my life. It really was still terrifying the next year, but you know, everyone always would say, well, that's when you know you're doing the right thing, is when you're to do the thing that terrifies you.
Right.
And I guess I understand. That seems to make sense. I don't know. It was like jumping out of an airplane. It really was. And I am so happy that they came back, because it really was a huge mistake that was made out of a bundle of fears.
Right. Once you did get on, I know for a while there was a lot of uncertainty every year whether you'd be asked back, right? I mean, oh, I think there was, and then it's at a certain point that turned to you kind of becoming one of Lauren's favorites, and eventually him supporting MacGruber, and you being able to go off and be one of those lucky cast members that gets to turn a sketch into a feature-length film.
Oh, yeah.
But I wonder, did you feel that shift take place when you went from not having job security to you know that you're in?
There was a point after the third season, there's a point in the summer where they are supposed to tell you if they're picking up your contract for the next year. And they came to me and said, okay, we want to take a little longer. And they were doing that with a lot of people's contracts because it was a couple years after Will Ferrell had left. So they were still trying to figure out what the new direction of the show was going to be. And I think I was the very last person picked up. And it was a real wake-up call because I thought, oh, I have lost this job. And one of the things Lauren said to me was, you have a writer's mindset. And when you do things that you write, you do them very confidently without fear. But when you do stuff that other people have written, you're very tentative and you've got to own it more. You're just coming from a writer's mind instead of a performer's mind. And of course I'm like, oh, you're high. You don't know. I didn't say this to him, but in my mind I was like, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's crazy. But then the more I thought about it, he's absolutely right. Like I was just, because I could remember being a writer myself and writing stuff for people, and then they'd maybe be doing it differently than you had thought, and you'd be back there going, oh, this person's ruining what I've written. And in my head, when I was performing other people's stuff, I would just imagine that they were back there unhappy with the way I was doing it in the same way that that I was when I was a writer. But Lauren was absolutely right. I was thinking too much about it. He said, you gotta just, take ownership of the stuff, the writers want you to, put your flag in it and kind of make it your own. And he was absolutely right. Once I got so close to the edge there and thought that I was not going to be coming back and got this advice from Lauren, it just really changed everything around. I kind of came in with a reckless abandon and kind of treated everything, in the way that I treated the stuff that I would write myself. Really? Like when you write stuff yourself, you know exactly how you want to do it. So, and you're the writer, so when you're disappointing someone, you're just disappointing yourself. And I don't care if I disappoint myself, that's fine.
So you actually were able to take that advice and make a major shift.
Oh yeah, yeah. And yeah, it was the best thing that could have happened for me was to get so close to the edge. And I didn't want to give him the credit for this at the time, but when I look back, that was a huge turning point, was the situation I was in and the advice I was given by him, and it just really became a much different experience and so much more fun. And it almost just relaxed me in a way to almost be fired. It just seemed like, okay, well, I wasn't fired, now it's all gravy. I could have been fired and then that would have been the end of that experience. So just, have fun now.
Amazing.
Don't worry about it as much.
Amazing. Because it seems like once you make that turn, then, and you can relax into it, you're on a different level of performer at that point, right? And it seems to me like at a certain point, you go from the new guy on the show to an established, I'm here. Like, did you feel that shift at some point where you didn't even have any job security fears or anything?
It took a long time for me to feel like that, because I just had so much respect for everybody who had been at the show before me that I would always feel like, oh, this is their show, and I'm just getting to be a part of this institution that all these people before me have founded, and I felt like a renter, not an owner.
You did.
And then after, God, it probably wasn't until my sixth or seventh season that you just feel like,
I belong.
I'm a part of this. Like, this is, I don't know. I don't know why it took me so long to feel like that. It certainly was not anybody else's fault but my own, just my own insecurities, my own weird things. Some people just had that feeling right away. It feels like, all right, I'm a part of this right from the get-go. And I never had that sense of confidence.
But does that make you work
harder?
Because
I would feel like, oh, it's a sense of entitlement almost.
Right.
But there's a fine line between those two. And I would, I didn't want to veer into an entitlement area. So I think I pulled back too much. And I definitely had stage fright for a long time.
Wow. Yeah, I did read that you talked something about on your first ever show, you were worried about even being able to get the words out of your mouth.
Oh, yeah.
On live television.
Yeah, I was petrified. I was on top of this bunk bed. It was a Hannibal Lecter goes to college sketch.
Right.
And Matt Damon was Hannibal Lecter, from what I remember. Yeah, he was Hannibal Lecter. And all I had to say was, dude, I told you he was gay. And I was, I'm up there. That's the only line I have. I don't know when the cameras are on me and when they're not on me. So when I know they're not on me, I'm trying to, like,
You're already in a fetal position because you're in bed.
No, and I was like, what if my mouth doesn't open? What if my tongue forgets how to move? It was overthinking everything, and somehow the words came out really slowly, but they came out. So I thought, okay, step one, saying a couple words, done. I don't think I got any laugh, but it was baby steps.
Yeah, again, the reverse in the control room, and everyone's kind of watching, and I'm sure there's that, come on, pulling for you, right? Yes. The new guy, he's got his first line. I mean, I'm sure there was there some sort of a, initiation ritual?
It's like a family there, so everyone is very supportive and nice, but there's, I guess the answer is yes. It's not a structured welcome, but everyone is very aware that you're the new person. They're very helpful and try to give you advice. Tracy Morgan used to come my first season all the time and come in and give me advice. It was so fun because he's such a fun, interesting person. But he was really good to me my first year.
Really,
would always take the time to come in and remind me just to have fun, because I think I just overthink everything in my life. So,
do you think that overthinking happens across the board of what you do? In other words, do you overthink more as a performer than you do as a writer?
I think definitely, I would overthink stuff in the early going because everything seems like it's like first impression stuff. So it's really important. These little phrases could make the difference between something being people would find funny and versus not funny. And at the very beginning, you need everything to be really funny because you want the people you're working with to like you and respect you. So so in my head, it's crazy, but you would think, throw me the ball. I don't know, you think some stuff like that matters.
Right.
And sometimes, every once in a while, a little word like that will matter, but most of the time, it doesn't matter at all.
But you find a way to make all those things matter.
For hours, I would think about stuff like that. Yeah.
Take me through the process of pitching an idea at the table read. I would imagine your kind of humor at a table read or at a pitch meeting or whatever is harder to get across until you're fully in costume, you've got wigs, you've got scenery. Was it hard sometimes to get something that you knew was great through the table read and picked up for the show?
The pitch meetings were tricky because you don't want to give away the joke of the sketch because you want people to laugh at it on Wednesday when you do the table read. Because you do a pitch with the host on Monday.
Okay.
And then you're writing Monday night and Tuesday night. And then all the things that you've written are done. You sit down for a table read with the whole cast and the host on Wednesday. So you want people to be surprised and not know the joke. So you have to pitch it in such a way that it doesn't reveal the joke, but still sounds kind of interesting. Or sometimes you would just pitch something, like just make a fake pitch so that nobody knows anything about what your idea is.
Right.
And then go out. Okay, yeah, because a lot of times I either wouldn't have an idea yet on the Monday afternoon, or I would have an idea that was so, just the germ of an idea.
There must have been frustrating experiences for you when you had something you liked at the table read and it getting shot down. Like, did you have experiences like that?
Oh, all the time. It was very frustrating at times because especially the stuff I like is, or would usually end up writing would be on the more absurd side. And it's tricky because absurd stuff doesn't appeal to everyone. So usually they'll try to do that stuff towards the end of the show. And a lot of times it could make it through the whole week, get picked to go into the show, and then even get picked from the dress rehearsal show to go into the live show. And then you run out of time, you can't do it. Or they're saying, oh, can you take out 2 pages out of this? And you're like, no, I can't. Every word is priceless. No, but that's was kind of the danger of doing that kind of stuff.
Like, for instance, take the spelling bee sketch you did.
Yeah.
Like, you tried to get that through a lot of weeks before you finally got it on, right? Like, you really believed in that, and that was literally the very thing we're talking about. Here's a guy that says about 65 letters in a row until finally you're just like, how can he still be saying letters, right? And it becomes so hilarious. And that sketch killed. But that was an example of you not getting that past the table read for a long time, right?
Yes. I had done that sketch at the Groundlings probably 25 times. And it had done very well. It's just a very simple idea, but I can't imagine. There are a couple things that were going against it for Lauren is that it's first of all, the host is not in it that much, which makes it tricky to get to sell a host on it.
Right.
And second of all, it's a risky joke because it's just repeating letters over and over again. So it's easy for a director at the Groundlings to say, oh, let's give this a shot. Because, you know, there are 99 people in that theater.
Right.
And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And, you know, it's just a couple minutes. But for Lauren, this is, you know, potentially, he's got to build a set. He's got to, you know, do a whole week of production on this pretty risky piece. So I understand why it took him a while to agree to do it.
Right.
And I feel bad because I did put it up a bunch of times and finally I think he just did it to get me to shut up. And then I was really nervous when he picked it. I was like, oh, this better go well.
Tell me about Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin. That's the one that got away. There's one sketch that it's the spelling bee that didn't get put on. Like, I love this sketch. Me and my friend John Solomon wrote it together. And it's just about this guy who gets set up on a date with this woman who is the spitting image of Benjamin Franklin. Like, with a little, you know, bald spot up here, the male pattern baldness. But her name was Jenjamin Franklin, and she's really, she's very sensual. And yeah, we wanted that one bad, and for some reason we kept putting it up, and
why wouldn't
Lauren was not going for it. I don't know. I don't know. I'd love it. I don't know. Maybe it was too weird.
I think that's the hardest thing.
But
about
everyone
idea.
There like has sketches they wish could have gotten on. It's like I'm not the only person who's, you know, it just is the way that show is. It's the way it is, and I wouldn't change a thing about it. I love Lauren with all my heart, and he has been just the best to me. And I am just nothing but thankful towards him. So he can cut as many Benjamin Franklins as he wants. I will still love him.
Well, before we get off of Saturday Night Live, I just want to ask you if there are any good office prank stories.
Oh, man. Oh, a lot of things that just make me seem like a really gross person. There was this wonderful guy there, Eric Sloven, and he's this really funny comedian and wrote there for about 3 years. We wrote The Falconer together, he and I and Leo Allen, who was his writing partner. And I don't know how this tradition started, but there was a tradition in which I used to cut off my pubic hair and sprinkle it on his keyboard. And then the tradition of him unplugging his keyboard and moving it over and taking my existing keyboard with no pubic hairs and using that one instead. And then the second year that I did it, it was like, well, now I know that other one already had pubic hair on it, so what keyboard do I use now? So I don't know if he just took somebody else's keyboard and they kind of unknowingly... But these are the kinds of gross things that just kind of happen, you know. It's just gross.
Well...
It's just gross.
Sometimes having, you know, a pubic hair in a story just makes it great. But let's move on.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was... We had some nice conversation before, and then I sullied it.
I love talking about Saturday Night Live because I was such a fan all the way through of that show. But what really fascinates me and what I want to talk about next is that you have made a serious shift from comedic roles with the most recent two films that you have just finished, Run and Jump and Nebraska. And I saw Nebraska, and I have to say I'm just blown away with the film. I didn't have any expectations. I hadn't read the script. I didn't know much about it. And I went in there and I kind of wasn't expecting the level of empathy and kindness that you gave that character. And I just kind of walked out of there with a whole new level of respect for you.
Oh, well, and thank you.
So I have so many questions about it, but I guess starting, I happen to know that Alexander Payne considered maybe 100 actors in your generation for that role, and pretty much everyone wanted that role. Did you know that when you got it? Did you know how coveted the role of David was in Nebraska?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew that he had been wanting to do this movie for a long time, but I didn't know, you know, I don't know anything about the inner workings of Hollywood or anything. So I don't know much about that kind of stuff. I still can't believe that I got to be in this movie. I just never thought I'd get an opportunity like this.
Well, tell me about the moment when you heard you got the role. How did you hear?
He called me on the phone. It was an interesting process because originally my agent had said, Alexander Payne is making this movie in Nebraska. You should put yourself on tape, and he will look at your tape if you put yourself on tape. And never in a million years would I think that I'd have a shot to even clear the first hurdle. So I put myself on tape, it was four different scenes, and sent it in. And I saw the tape, and I thought, oh, this is not embarrassing. Like I would not want to send in something that I thought was an embarrassment. I put a lot of effort into it, but it was I don't think any of it was like, oh, this is because I have a legitimate shot at getting this role. I think it was, first of all, I just don't want to seem like a dipshit. I didn't know how to gauge it that well, so I even sent it in and told my agent and manager, tell me what you think. If you don't think this is something we should send in, let me know. It's just not something I'm used to. I'm not used to that kind of acting. So my calibration system is off, I did know, oh, this is not embarrassingly bad. I felt like, am I crazy? I feel like I did an all right job here. And then sent it in, and then didn't hear anything for 4 months, and thought, oh, well, you know, as I suspected, didn't get the part. At least I don't feel like I did a horrible job, and I, you know, whatever. I just move on and see what else is out there. And somehow after 4 months, after thinking that this was just kind of a dead situation, I heard that he had liked the tape enough to call me and to have me do it in person with him. And that was just a huge excitement right there. It was what a huge win to know that he had liked it at all. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know, does that mean, is he doing this with 500 people? Is he doing it with 3 people? I didn't know. So it was just exciting to know that this person who I had so much respect for didn't think I was an absolute idiot. And that was great. So I was incredibly nervous when I went in there, and we just went through the scenes one time each. I didn't feel like, oh, this, I nailed it. I did it enough in the ballpark that I thought, okay, well, that's kind of what I would be doing. So I didn't, it's not the best job I've ever done, but it was close enough so that I have no regrets. And he was very complimentary afterwards, and that was enough for me right there. It was like, oh my God, that's, you know, if this is as far as it goes, and it probably will be, then what an exciting thing to get to hear these nice compliments about your acting from a guy like Alexander Payne. Like, what an exciting thing. But still, you know, just thought nobody would be that insane to to give me this role. And like a month later, he called me on the phone and asked me to do it, and it was the most exciting phone call I've ever had. It was really, really, really exciting.
And then how do you take that, and then from that phone call to day one of shooting, what did you do to prepare for the role at that point?
I never wanted shooting to start. It was like, I had this awesome period where it was kind of like after I got the SNL job, and it's like, in my head, I could tell all my friends, hey, I got the SNL job, but I didn't want to actually do it. Like, then I have to actually, you know, conquer these fears and anxieties that I have. And so I was so excited and really looked forward to doing it. But then, yeah, I got very nervous and intimidated as the date was approaching that we had to start.
So what do you do? What do you physically do with the script to get yourself to that place?
Just read it a bunch, and that's pretty much it. Just kind of read it. In a weird way, there were a lot of relationships that I've had in my life that felt similar to the relationship that my character in the movie has with Bruce Dern, plays my dad, and it's my dad's wonderful. I have a great relationship with him, but just different elements of different relationships. I felt like I kind of knew who this guy was a little bit, which made it nice. But I was still, you know, I still find things to get nervous about.
Did it take you a little bit of time to find your footing first yeah. couple days of shooting?
Yeah, well, the nice thing was he had me come out a little early to just hang out and absorb the geography of Nebraska, and it's this nice group of people that are all so good at what they do. They've all worked with each other before, and it's like they really welcomed me in, and especially Alexander made me feel really comfortable, and it was, and you know, I was still a little nervous about stuff and intimidated, but I kind of quickly learned, like, oh, that's, you know, that's just, I got to just get out of my head and just enjoy this experience. And Alexander was great about getting me out of my head, and Bruce was great about getting out of, I mean, everyone was, but those are the people I was spending the majority of my time with, and they were both so patient and just relaxing. They were great, and Bruce just tells the best stories. So it was a really fun experience. And Alexander, just like he just knows exactly what he wants, and that there's something about his calm nature and his confidence that just really puts you at ease. So I was able to kind of quickly not worry about that stuff.
When I spoke to Bruce about the film, he talked about you and your performance being the thing that made this film so magical, and about how, as an actor, he felt like your willingness to serve the movie rather than yourself made the film what it was. And he said the only thing that at the beginning that you had to overcome was maybe your own self-doubt at how perfect you were for the role and how well you were doing it. And I wonder if, you know, there was a moment where you went, like Saturday Night Live, where you went from, what am I doing here on Alexander Payne's movie, to, I can do this.
It was such a new experience, and so just when I would think that I would, like, oh, I'm getting the hang of this, and I feel like I've, you know, there would always be some new wrinkle, and I didn't go to acting school or any, you know, I was a history major, and all my acting was done at the Groundlings, which is an amazing place, but it's a comedy theater, and you're doing space work, and so I'm just not a trained actor, so I feel like sometimes it's just stuff that the things that I'll encounter that are problems are just confidence problems or just, I don't know, things that people who have maybe gone through acting school wouldn't worry about. And the crazy thing is, the things that I would worry about probably aren't things that they teach you in acting school. But because I've never went to any kind of acting school, or what do they call them, drama school? I don't know. I know they don't call it acting school. But because I didn't have that experience, in my head, in the back of my head, I'd go, oh, somebody who went to this school, this kind of training, maybe they had some specific thing on how to deal with this, you know, when they probably didn't. I don't know. These were the kinds of things that would float around my head. And it just, and that was why just the more time I spent with Bruce, the more he would put me at ease with stuff like that and just go, like, you know, don't worry about it. You're doing fine. You know, just essentially, like, it's no different than the acting you do in comedy. It's just slightly different. In comedy, you're just trying to be true to the scene you're in and do the most truthful representation of what the character is doing in the scene that you're in. And you're just like, oh, I just want to believably be at this place and time. So it's just all about, it's essentially you're doing the same thing just in a different way. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Totally, it makes sense.
I'm sure that there is a more eloquent way to put that.
No, I hear what you're saying.
And they talk about that in acting school. I'm positive about it.
I hear what you're saying. I think that, you know, comedy isn't funny because you're doing some silly dance in every scene.
Yeah.
Comedy is funny because you're a person in a situation and how you deal with that. And you're right, you have to be totally in that situation.
There are a lot of people in Alexander Payne's movies that are that have never acted before in their lives. There are people who are farmers from Nebraska that he just cast because they, you know, they'll come in, they'll read, and he's so good at getting these wonderful performances from these people with no acting experience. And that kind of taught me something like, oh, you know, just don't try so much to act. Just kind of let the writing speak for itself, and just kind of, I don't know, sometimes the words really do the work for you, and you just don't try to overdo it too much. I don't know, that was my tricky part, was like, I'm from big, broad comedy background, so it's just finding the level of believability of like, oh, I don't want to overdo it, like in that, but I don't want to go too far the other way and underdo it. So like, where's that completely believable point? Does that make sense? God, now I feel like...
No, it makes
now
sense.
Now we've gotten into all this acting stuff.
No, but that's...
You realize just what a sham this is. God.
No, I think that with Alexander, you're right. I mean, he does cast a lot of people. Because they have a look, or because they feel like they fit the scene. And just sitting here talking to you, you're very self-effacing and very, very kind of quick to give others credit. And I think those are things that are in the character of David.
There was something that Alexander did say once that was right before we started shooting. I think I was saying, "Do you want this? Should I be more this? Should I be more that?" And he said something to the effect that like. They're bringing you in because they think that you are, you know, they think your personality is right for this. So it's like 80% of this character is you. You just have to work on the 20% or something like that. And he gave me that bit of advice, and then that made it seem much better. It was like oh, okay, I understand. So you kind of want me to play just a kind of normal version of myself, and just kind of, so it made, the way he described it, it made a lot more sense than the way that I described it. It was overall a very intimidating experience at first, but Alexander and Bruce, it was like just going to this crazy drama school and just learning from these masters on the run. Like, you know, that's the best thing there is, to get to watch Bruce Dern act these words. It's like, oh, okay.
Bruce told me that you, whether the cameras were rolling or not, you would kind of help him down the stairs, help him into the car if the car already had cameras on it, much like a father and son dynamic. And he said that without being asked, without being prompted, you were just kind of looking out for him and helpful towards him. And when I hear that story, I think, well, maybe Alexander saw some of that too, some of this natural ability to just see what someone else needs.
I can't answer those questions. I don't know why he picked me. I'm so thankful he did.
He never took you aside and said, here's why I picked you.
What he told me was something about believability of, you know, just, oh, I believed in what you're doing, and I feel like I kind of know you already. And there was something I think he wanted from that
right
character, I guess.
Would he find the perfect thing to say that would put you in the mind frame of the scene?
He knows exactly what he wants. That's the one, the main thing about him. He knows exactly what he wants, and sometimes his direction would be very specific and to the point, and sometimes it would be super general, almost confusingly general, but everything was done for a purpose. It's hard not to feel like you're in just completely wonderful hands. Like so it was always very interesting to hear what he would tell you about what he would want you to do differently. Because sometimes it would be so specific, like, oh, stress this word over that, and then say this part slower and this part faster. And sometimes it would just be, I don't even know how to describe how, it would just like, just do it differently or something like that. It would always be the perfect direction. He was, he's just like, he is amazing to watch.
Was having a comedic acting background a way to bring a different approach to a dramatic role?
It's very interesting because the role that I play in the movie is really kind of a straight man, and I would say there were times when it almost, I would say having a comedic background maybe even hurt, because there would be lines that I wasn't sure, oh, am I supposed to put a little something on this line to, you know, there some things that you might think could read as jokes. I don't know. It there were just things that, and then I just realized, oh, just say them like, say these lines like a normal person. Don't worry about, you know, just try to be as realistic with the lines as you can. And there are almost two different ways you could approach things.
Right.
If my character was telling a joke in the script or something that sounded like a joke, am I telling the joke well, or am I, or am I somebody who does not tell the joke well? Like, it's very tricky. Like, what level of, you know, mustard do I put on this?
In the scene where Bruce is Woody loses his teeth at the railroad tracks, there, that's a funny scene, but it's not played like a comedy. And yet I feel like the timing, if you guys both didn't get it right, it wouldn't have played. I don't know, I see coming from a comedy background being very helpful in those kind of situations.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's crazy to not think that it would help. You know, it absolutely helps in certain scenarios. And there's like a, you know, with scenes, there's a rhythmic component to a lot of scenes with dialogue and stuff. And I think having a comedy background helps with that. But then again, it's like, that's just, you know, I mean, there are rhythms to every, even dramatic dialogue has, you know, a rhythm to it. So, I don't know, does that make sense?
It does. It's funny hearing you talk about
this. It's so weird for me because this stuff is so out of my comfort zone. I'm not used to talking about it. So when you ask me all these questions, it's so hard to figure out how to answer them because I just don't, I'm still learning about all this stuff. I'm still figuring out what it's all about. So it's to try to talk about anything about my process. It's a completely evolving process, and it's even, you know, I'm still just getting used to it. So I'm barely comfortable with comedic acting at this point. I've been doing that for a long time, so it's weird to try to act about or, you know, talk about this stuff because I'm still figuring it out myself.
Well, people are going to see this film and say he knew exactly what he was doing.
The script is beautifully written, and somehow this character made sense to me. So it's you have a guy telling you exactly what he wants in Alexander Payne. You have this guy who's doing the majority of the heavy lifting acting-wise in Bruce Dern. My job is much easier than it looks, because it's, you know, there's so many wonderful people who are helping me get the job done. In this business where you don't know when you're gonna ever have your next job or your last job, it's just a very special thing to have been given an opportunity to do something like this, because it's, you just go, God, I, you know, if I never get an opportunity to do anything again, I got to be in an Alexander Payne movie in like one of the main roles, and I got to work with Bruce Dern, and you know, every day I'm going to work and I'm watching this movie that just you're seeing this thing get made, and it's, I get the best seat in the house. I'm like, you're Bruce Dern and I'm me, and I'm just sitting here watching this magical performance every day and just going, oh my God, am I crazy or is this as special as I think it is? And then I got to see the movie finally. I was like, oh, it was as special as I thought it was.
After seeing the film, I walked away, and I don't want to give away the movie, but I mean, I think anyone who's any man who's had any kind of relationship with their father, troubled or not, is going to recognize and have feelings for some of the choices that your character makes in there. I think it's the job you did was so great and it's so well deserved that it's fascinating for me to sit here and listen to you be so kind of flabbergasted that you're in that position, because you truly, truly pulled it off.
I mean, I don't want to come off as having zero confidence in myself. I'm a confident, it's so weird because I'm a weird mixture. At the heart of my being, I am very confident in myself. I am a confident person, but then there's this outer layer of insecurity that gets in the way of it sometimes. I would way rather underestimate myself and be excited and surprised than overestimate myself and be an asshole. You know, it's hard to watch yourself act. It's just hard. It's hard to do. And it was hard for a long time to watch me in comedy stuff. And then I got used to it. And then you just get used to it. And so it's kind of hard to it's been an interesting experience in watching these screenings where I'm just playing a much more real character, and it's much closer to who I am in real life. So you feel kind of vulnerable. You know, you feel like people are seeing the way you actually act in very private moments. You know, which is interesting. Like, oh, that's, now I know what he's like when he's
right. No one's going to watch MacGruber and say, that's exactly who that guy is.
That's what he's like when he's got celery in his butt.
Right.
It's exactly, yeah.
But, yeah, I guess I never thought of it that way before. As an actor, you're using stuff from your real life. And it's very private. I find it fascinating that you could keep the arc of the character so well intact, knowing how out of sequence you shot the film. And I wonder if that's hard for you to keep a sense of who that character is and what he is going through as the movie progresses, shooting out of sequence.
The main thing is, if you go into the process really knowing the script very well, you know, the longer you're kind of immersed in the character, the more it kind of crystallizes in a way that you can't prepare for before you start production, you know? I've never been involved in anything that shot in sequence, but I think that the director is also really aware of the scenes that are important to not do till later in a story. And they're, you know, sometimes they'll be forced to do something they would want to do, save till later in the production schedule. They might have to do it earlier, but for the most part, they'll try to save stuff that, you know, till later in, later in the production. Stuff that might be more emotional or I don't know. Every once in a while you'll hear of people who are, oh yeah, that was, we had to, like their first day of filming is some make-out scene with the character. Like, couldn't we wait a couple weeks till we get to know each other as people and then, I don't know, but maybe that's a director's choice at times to, you know, to really throw you into the fire right away, you know, and you probably feel really close to the person after you make out with them at the very beginning.
You hope.
This did not happen in Nebraska, by the way. Bruce Dern and I did not make out in this movie.
Spoiler alert.
Or did we?
We did not. I once heard a talk with Leonardo DiCaprio where he goes through the scenes and he puts A-R or N-A next to each scene. A-R is acting required, and N-A is no acting.
That was the tricky thing, is like it's, not that it's easy to act with dialogue, but it's, when I have dialogue, I know, oh, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, and you know, and the words are coming out of your mouth, so it's kind of explaining what you're doing, but sometimes that's what I had to learn a little more, is like, oh, how do I act when I'm not talking. Like, you want to just do it the way a normal person would do it. And sometimes once there is a camera introduced into the mix, things that you think would be no-brainers suddenly are things that you overthink. Like you, oh, like I remembered at some point just having to run across through this, from this car, the car at the gas station, into this bar. And I'm just running, and it's like, I felt like I didn't know how to run anymore because I know the camera's on me. It's like, oh, this is so weird. I think I'm running differently than I usually do, or I don't know. It's just, it's weird, and you just realize, and that, like, it's that kind of thing that you can overthink throughout the making of the movie, and that's what I would be grappling with sometimes. Is just like, if I have time to think, I will tend to overthink stuff, and so it's I don't know. It's all just. That was the biggest trick for them, I think, is just getting me out of my head and just get, you know, because I tend to overthink everything.
Right, right.
Yeah. I have been such a huge fan of his for so long. I was just intimidated by it. I just didn't want to let anybody down.
Yeah.
Like, you know, here's this guy who has given me the chance of a lifetime, and I don't want to let him down and, you know, mess up his movie. And Bruce is so amazing. And At first I was like, oh, what if he's, you know, I didn't know. I had never met him, so I don't know what kind of person he is. And thank God he turned out to be this really sweet and nice teacher type, as opposed to, you know, some asshole. Like, he, you know, it could have been the craziest experience with the way that my head works if I didn't have somebody like Alexander and somebody like Bruce as the two major components in this. I might have gone crazy. They were such good teachers. The main thing that they taught me, I mean, there were so many things, but was just like, my biggest enemy is just my own head, and just get out of your head. Don't worry about it. Just don't overthink it.
Did this experience somehow fuel your juices or your creativity to go out and with a broader palette or whatever, write something for yourself?
It sounds so dumb, but it really is true. It was such a huge emotional journey for me and taught me a lot about myself. I would love to try to do all kinds of different fun things, and would love to try to put myself in a position to try new experiences. I never thought that I'd get an experience to do something like this. So that, right. That's why what an exciting thing. And this, if anything, this just proved to me, there is hope that there are even more new experiences that I might not know. I'll, you know, might not think I ever would have a chance to do, but this just shows me that really anything is possible. This is something I would have never expected.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like the film, you know, has put you in this position where that world's going to open up to you a lot more. I mean, do you kind of feel like you're on the precipice of a much wider field of opportunity opening up? Just because I feel like people are going to see this movie and they're going to see you in a whole new light.
Well,
do you feel that sense, that anticipation?
I don't know how people will react to it. It would be wonderful if they saw it and liked it, and you know, obviously I would love to have more opportunities like this, or to just try different fun, cool things. And it's, I love doing comedy. I love it so much. But it's been really nice to get to try this new thing. And it would be fun to try other new things. Just everything is gravy after this. I don't deserve anything. I don't, you know, I'm like, there are a lot of people trying to do comedy, trying to act trying to do, I am just so delighted to have had any bit of success, and I do not take it for granted. I'm fully aware of what a rare experience this is for any actor, so I'm very appreciative of it, and where it leads from here, I have no idea. If this is the last job I have, wow, what a one to go out on, you know?
You've talked at length about your OCD in interviews, and I wonder if that is somehow something that you've been able to turn around and use to your advantage as well as an actor, as a performer.
I would say as a writer and performer, it's way more of a strength than a weakness because it gives you this hyper focus and you, at least with the way mine is, like it leads to a lot of tuning out everything in your life and just focusing on the task at hand and going to it. The bummer of the flip side is that it can get tricky with personal life stuff, like when you have other people in your life and you're so focused on this one thing, like that hyper focus, you know, everything else is ignored. You don't email people back for months and months. You know, it can be tricky, and I feel like I've tried to read books about it, and there was something about it. I went to Ireland last summer, and something about being back there. My phone did not work back there. My family wasn't back there, my friends, so I just had a lot of time to think. I was working for like 2 months, and so I just had a lot of time to think about stuff, and I came back a slightly different person, and the scope of it is not as intense as it can be. Like, I can leave the house and stuff. I just do have weird little rituals and stuff of checking the locks and checking stoves and stuff like that. But it also bleeds over into other things in my life.
Has it made it harder in terms of relationships, girlfriends, stuff like that?
Yeah, I would have never thought that it affected that stuff in my life. But then, definitely. There was an ex that I had that got me the book that I read.
Okay.
And I did realize, like, oh, yeah, this isn't just about checking my faucets and checking the stove and checking the locks. This kind of extends itself into every area of my life in one way or another. And I think, you know, a ton of people, I'm not alone in this. I think a lot of people who don't even know that they have it, probably have it to some degree.
Well, I think it's interesting because OCD is defined and there's books about it, but I think we all realize when we get to a certain age, and I think the 40s are a great time to realize this, is that we all have a basket of stuff that can stand in our way if we refuse to acknowledge that it's part of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think the best part about getting older is really accepting yourself. Because then once you do that, once you like know who you are, then you can deal with everything. It would be much worse if you walked around saying, no, I don't have OCD. Yeah. I can't let anyone find that out, right?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I kind of was that way for a long time. I wouldn't hide the OCD so much, but I would kind of stubbornly refuse to think that it had as much of an effect on me as other people probably thought it did. I've turned into kind of a different person in the last couple of years, and a much more open person and willing to realize that I'm not the perfect person that I thought I was, you know, up until my 40s. And you realize, oh, that's right. I'm just, you know, I got my bag of stuff, like you said.
Right.
Who cares if people know I have OCD or, you know.
Very freeing to be able to say
absolutely.
That, right? Are there things along the way that you've had to do that really have felt like work, or what you've had to learn to do that feels like work and doesn't feel like fun that have made you a more successful person?
You know, work is work. Even when you're, you know, doing what you love, you still have to work at it. And you know, the great thing is I have fun at work. I love work, and everything I've ever done. And there are things that this will be surprising for people to hear, because they, you know, might see some things that I've been in. They go like, "Oh, he's proud of that, or proud of this." And there's nothing I've done that didn't teach me something super valuable, or provide some really wonderful experience in my life. So I just won't enter into something if there's not some really positive aspect of it. Like sometimes it'll, you know, sometimes it's just I love the people who are doing something, and maybe I don't like the script as much, or you know, or sometimes, but I've not done something for the money, and I feel like that's a big part of it. Like I don't think I've ever been offered something for a lot of money. So it's, but it's, you know, it's nothing's ever been offered to me that was a huge piece of crap.
And what a great position to be in, right?
Yeah.
To be in a position where every project, at least going into it, felt like you were going into it for the right reasons. I mean, that's all we want to do as yeah. creators or artists is go into something with an open mind and an open heart that it can be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's like, oh, well, yeah, the script is not perfect, but I love these people I'm working with. And why wouldn't I want to spend several months with a bunch of people who make me happy? Oh, right. What a right. great experience to have.
That is something that just thinking about how a Nebraska's going to come out, and there'll be a big deal made out of it, because it's a very good film, and the easy storyline for a journalist to go to would be, hey, here's this guy that everyone thought of as MacGruber, and here he is doing this very serious straight man role in an Alexander Payne film. So I think in that light, it's an interesting time for you that I think maybe all that's coming for you. I see that as something's about to change a little bit. It will bring you a different kind of audience, maybe.
If that happened, that'd be wonderful. You know, I've learned not to get my hopes up over anything. I am all I can say is I am really proud of this movie. It is such an honor to be a part of it, and it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful movie, and what comes from it, I have no desire to think about anything except for my pride in the movie and how thankful I am to have gotten to be in it. And just for every, you know, this is an experience I'll take to my grave, and be delightful if this helped me to get to do other things. But that's so, you know, there are so many aspects of thinking in that way that make me uncomfortable. It's like I don't want to, all I want to think about is just how happy I am in this moment with how beautiful this movie is and how excited I am to have gotten to be a part of it.
Was there a point when you had to kind of make your own peace with the fact that you were no longer a totally private person? That you could walk down the street and be recognized by a stranger, that someone would come up and want to take a picture with you. You know, along with all of this we're talking about, was it hard to make your peace with that aspect of your job?
It's weird. It is weird. I can't imagine, like, I'm low on the radar of people, so it's relative to, you know.
Sure.
There are people who know me from SNL, but I don't have, it's not like everywhere I go people are coming up all the time.
No, but when it happens.
But it's, I can't imagine like being a kid like Justin Bieber or something, where you're so huge at such a young age, because I didn't even start until I was 32, so I was already kind of who I am as an adult. So it's weird even for the teeny number of people that come up to me. It's weird, and you know, more and more people will come up as the longer you're doing it, but it's still not a crazy overwhelming number of people that I deal with. So it's what bugs me is sometimes it feels like you'll read mean stuff. People right. say mean stuff, and it's like, I'm all for a okay critique, a fair critique. People don't have to like everything you do, but just be a citizen of the world and not be a jerk about it. Like, there's a way of fairly critiquing something you find negative and doing it in a way that where you're not an asshole. It's kind of easy to hide behind these, you know, computer, email, now it seems like an old man.
It seems like you have a code of conduct that you kind of adhere to, and it's important for you, and it bothers you when other people don't have that, right? I mean, is that important to you, like being a good guy?
Yeah. I think it's important to try to be a good person. I mean, you know, am I a good person all the time? I try to be, and sometimes I'm not, and it bums me out when I'm not. But I got no patience for people who are just outwardly bad people.
Well, listen, since I've met you and worked with you, I have nothing but great things to say because...
Well, I could say the same of you.
Well, you know, you did hump a bass for me and...
that bass was asking for it.
And you did just about anything I asked while being sick. And now you're here. But I honestly couldn't think of a nicer guy to have all this happen to. And, you know, I just wish you all the
Thank
best
you
success
very much.
With this film and with future stuff.
I'm sorry for sweating all over your chair. This chair
oh, that was sweat.
Is sopping wet now. I had to hold my arm here because I started sweating so much. It's hot in this room, by the way.
I know. Well, it's hot and quiet.
I love how I had to directly address the camera on that.
Yes, as if the camera's responsible for
yeah.
that. Well, thank you for doing
Thank
this.
You. No, this is it was really fun talking to you.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.